Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance, arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we begin the show with sports and politics after Matt Fitzpatrick got his first tour win and his first major win, winning the U.S. Open. Great tournament over the weekend. And, of course, it occurs against the backdrop of LIV versus the PGA, the LIV Saudi-funded tour versus the PGA. And this was much in controversy throughout the U.S. Open as well. Over the weekend, Greg Norman, who is the hired gun of the Saudis for their new tour, was on Fox and Friends with Brian Kilmeade, making the case that the LIV can coexist with the PGA, even though that doesn't seem to be the PGA's posture. Take a listen.
Yeah, I'm disappointed, Brian, because we want to coexist. Right from the get-go, the whole business model we built was from ground up. And the whole business model was exactly what I just mentioned, was to coexist in all the current ecosystems within the game of golf. And we want to do that with the PGA Tour. You know, and if I was a PGA Tour, I'd sit back and I'd try and study and understand how can we coexist. This is what the players are looking for. This is what the players are excited about doing. And this is what they want to do. And basically the fans, Brian, we did over a year research around the world on fans. And it overwhelmingly came back. The fans wanted to have, you know, individual right. golf and team golf. And this is what the LIV product is all about. And going beyond all that, understanding what the franchise model and the possibility of building out franchise value for these principal players and captains and team members has never been done before in golf. So right. the upside here is enormous for the sport and enormous for everybody who plays with it. And be honestly, with the PGA Tour, when we coexist, if we can coexist.
Yeah, the question still becomes, you know, what is the Saudis' end game here? Why are they throwing hundreds of millions of dollars at these pros, mostly who are aging out or who have potential injuries that compromise their long-term potential, like Bryson DeChambeau? What's in it for the Saudis? And as we've been talking about this for the last several weeks, is this the globalization of American sports? Not in terms of recognition, but in terms of analogous to the globalization of corporate America that occurred over the last 40 years. And is it replete with danger, much like it was for our supply chains, as we found out during the pandemic, now for sort of America's cultural heritage, of which sport is an integral part?
Well, do you think basketball will be next, or tennis, or anything else? Do you think they'll start with golf and then move on to other sports?
You're talking about the Saudis specifically?
Yeah, the Saudis,
well,
yeah.
I think the Chinese have beaten the Saudis to the punch when it comes to the NBA. But we talk about this in all facets. The Confucius Institutes that the Chinese communists funded on college campuses, the professorships they funded. There's a story over the week in the Wall Street Journal about how much money Texas A&M has received from Qataris, from the Russians, and questionable whether or not they reported in compliance with the law. But these foreign influences, and this is not to say Fortress America, isolate, don't recognize the rest of the world, don't collaborate with our allies. No, of course. I'm a free trader, for goodness sakes. But I think the questions to be raised here are important, particularly when it is competitors that are being funded by I think it's fair to say, enemies of this country. Thus, the 9/11 families responding to Phil Mickelson and the other players who took the Saudi money and left the PGA. Now, contrast this with what John Rahm had to say, what you heard from Greg Norman, what you've heard sort of in mealy-mouthed defenses, I would describe them, from the likes of Phil Mickelson. Listen to John Rahm during the Open this weekend addressing the LIV Tour and why he chose to stay.
I do see the appeal that other people see towards the LIV Golf. I do see some of the, I put this delicately, points or arguments they can make towards why they prefer it. To be honest, part of the format is not really appealing to me. Shotgun 3 days to me is not a golf tournament, no cut. It's that simple. I want to play against the best in the world in a format that's been going on for hundreds of years, right? So that's what I want to see. And yeah, money is great, but when Kelly and I, this first thing happened, we started talking about it. We're like, will our lifestyle change if I got $400 million? No, it will not change one bit. Truth be told, I could retire right now with what I've made, and I've lived a very happy life and not play golf again. So I've never really played the game of golf for monetary reasons. I play for the love of the game, and I want to play against the best in the world. I've always been interested in history and legacy, and right now the PGA Tour has that. There's some meaning when you win the Memorial Championship. There's some meaning when you win Arnold Palmer's event at Bay Hill. There's some meaning when you win L.A., Torrey, some of these historic venues. And that, to me, matters a lot, right? I have, you know, after this winning this past U.S. Open, you know, only me and Tiger have won at Torrey Pines, and we're both the golf course that we like, making putts on the 18th hole, right? That's a memory I'm going to have forever that not many people can say. So my heart is with the PGA Tour. That's all I can say. It's not my business or my character to judge anybody who thinks otherwise. And for a lot of people, I'm not going to lie, those next 3-4 years are worth basically their retirement plan they're giving them. It's a very nice compensation to then retire and sail off to the sunset.
It must be nice that $400 million doesn't impact your lifestyle.
I know, that's the first thing.
But I mean,
he's a history and legacy. That's important. That's in the PGA.
Well, and I get what he's saying too, by the way. I mean, at a certain point, you're just buying more houses and cars and stuff.
Right.
I mean,
yeah, you know what that's like, Dan. It's a problem you deal with.
Once you can fly private, basically everything else is gravy.
Okay, so you flew private.
That's the threshold. Yes. But here's the thing. Yeah, what you just said, tradition. So that's what Rahm gets, tradition, history, a 500-year-old sport. That's what the last 100-plus years of major championships. That's what John Rahm gets, and it seems to me somebody like Phil Mickelson doesn't seem to, or doesn't seem to place the value on it that perhaps he should. Dan Henninger, our friend over at the Wall Street Journal, actually had a good piece on this over the weekend. Golf still has on-course officials interpreting arcane ball location rules, even as other sports are going the way of technology, replacing technology with human beings. Replacing human beings with technology. Think of tennis.
Oh, right.
Right, and the sensors. Yeah. Unlike in most sports, golfers quietly accept the rulings. At every level of the game, cheating remains the sport's unforgivable sin. Golf Central Act, the swing, permits no shortcuts to success for novices or the Masters champion. Every strike of the ball is freighted with the possibility of failure. Let the club face drift half an inch from perfect. Your ball may be in the woods. So why has this difficult support of golf survived and flourished, whether threatened by its frustrating physical challenges or Saudi oil money? And we know the answer because we learned it from Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. Tradition.
History, legacy.
Almost anywhere you look, balance through tradition has fallen from fashion. Embattled golf may be tradition's final bastion. That balance between, you know, tradition and threats to the sport, suggested innovations to the sport, competitors, you know, other leagues, USFL to NFL, ABA, NBA, all of that. But that history that's a part of the sport, you know, really informs so much of the value that not just the players place on it, but we place on it as a society, why we love these sports and sports leagues and particular franchises. And so it's sort of a parallel to what we talk about with American history when you have it under threat from the new Marxists like the 1619 Project. You just want to erase everything that's occurred up until this point and start anew. Well, you know, you don't get to do that, or you don't get to do that without consequence. And that's why I think this debate that's raging between the LIV Tour and the PGA, the PGA's approach to suspend, even as they allowed the guys in the LIV to play in the Open this weekend, the U.S. Open did. I think it's so interesting where we're at in this country. You know, part of what when we talk about, are we a declining empire? Are we losing our economic hegemony as well as our cultural hegemony? And you see NBA even more pronounced than the PGA. But you see this playing out, and it's a worthwhile discussion because it seems to me most Americans place more value on and pay more attention to sports than they do public policy. They understand that it's woven into our culture that helps define us as Americans. And so, should weigh in here. These sports, these traditions are nothing without the fans. And that's maybe what those guys who bolted from the PGA to the LIV are going to find out, even when they have their hundreds of millions in retirement planning set aside.
And Phil Mickelson, he didn't even make the cut, right? I mean, he played so poorly.
Yeah.
At the U.S. Open.
He did not make the cut.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, on this Juneteenth federal holiday.
Yeah, I thought we were off today. Driving into work, a little late, sorry about that.
Since this is a newly minted holiday, it just took effect last year.
And it fell on a Sunday, so now we're, honoring it today on Monday.
Honoring what?
I mean, saying, you don't have to go to work. If you're a federal employee, work at a bank, if you're a city worker, everybody's off. Mail today.
Does anybody know why?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can always text us at 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
This is supposed to be, by the way, the Juneteenth Independence Day celebration.
Yeah, there were a bunch over the weekend.
The Juneteenth Independence Day. Independence Day. What do you mean? Have you caught that? Have you caught that description of this holiday as the Independence Day? Independence from what? For who?
We have slaves.
Well, yeah, in Texas, the slaves weren't freed in toto until 2 years later. So this is something that grew out of a regional celebration. And of course, yeah, it's fine to honor people being freed from enslavement. Yeah. Sure, of course, that makes perfect sense. To federalize it as a holiday? To call it Juneteenth Independence Day? Those folks I saw twerking on cars in D.C. before the shooting started. This is part of the solemn observance of Juneteenth, is it? People know what this is. This is important in, as, for example, contrasted from Martin Luther King Day, in reflecting on our common humanity. This is a unifying day. This is a day that was born out, I mean, in terms of going from a regional observance to a federal holiday. This happened very quickly. I mean, it happened over a couple of decades in terms of states observing it. But before it became, you know, a paid day off and the push to federalize it, this was all summer of 2020. This is all George Floyd to last year. That's how quickly it happened, actually happened. So no one is denying the importance of observing and celebrating, recognizing the freeing of slaves in Galveston in Texas, which is where this date gained its significance. But to federalize it as a holiday and to characterize it the way it's being characterized, I'd be a little concerned about that. It sounds very much like what you would hear from the 1619 Project. It sounds very much like part and parcel of the race hustle that's going on from pre-K through post-secondary and in corporate offices the country over. In the arts community and everywhere else, basically. Observing Juneteenth, well, fine if you understand the history. Federalizing it, Juneteenth is our Juneteenth Independence Day. That sounds separatist to me, where July 4th is unified. Our country, all of us, regardless of your heritage, regardless of what horrors your ancestors faced. The descendants of slaves, it's just as much that person's country as it is my country as it is your country. That doesn't seem to be the message I'm hearing with respect to these Juneteenth celebrations. Am I missing it? Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hi. Good morning, Dan and Amy. I was distracted yesterday with all the Juneteenth stuff because of the U.S. Open, and I was so happy that I didn't see so many commercials for it until later in the night. But I thought if you start ambushing people on the street like Jesse Waters does and just do that quick interview and say, what are you doing for Juneteenth? Do you know why we're celebrating today or recognizing this as a holiday? You're off today. Are people off today, Dan?
You're not going to get any mail. Banks are closed.
I'm not off. Oh, my God. All right. Well, I mean, I took a 2-week break from the news to keep myself calmed down.
But yet you listen to the show.
Oh, always. Of course. You know, this is the show. I, you know, me and Bob from Buffalo Grove don't change the station. Neither do a lot of people. I thought that'd be fun. Just go ambush. I'm holding a couple classes this morning. I'll ask everybody if they know what's going on.
Ask them to give you a little bit of a education on the history of Juneteenth. See how well they do. Thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Appreciate it. Corey Bush, she's one of the newly minted Socialist Spice Girls from Missouri, St. Louis.
Yep.
On this Juneteenth, she tweeted, remember that millions of incarcerated black people are still in bondage and that the 13th Amendment still permits slavery.
What?
Our work is black liberation in its totality. So now you have some perspective on what I'm saying. People who are convicted of violent crimes, who are in prison, who happen to be black, are the same as black people who were enslaved in the 1860s in this country. Black liberation in its totality. I mean, these race hustlers, these identitarians, these Socialist Spice Girls and their fellow travelers, you understand they're black separatists, the way the Panthers were 60 years ago. this is the latest and greatest iteration of that poisonous Marxist philosophy. And it seems to me that Juneteenth is being used as yet another opportunity for them to spread their poison. Frank in Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. You know, this is just another example in some ways of our return to medievalism, just like, you know, the windmills, return to medieval times.
Yeah.
In medieval times, they had, you know, so many different feast days that, you know, everything just had to stop. And there's an opportunity cost for every single holiday that we have, no matter what we're talking about, Columbus Day, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, we're returning to that in many respects as a society. We're becoming unproductive. Everything's closed today. I mean, banks, stock market, you know, certain businesses. So
I wonder if,
you know,
medieval times, the restaurant is open today.
In Schaumburg. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we could,
I wonder.
We could go for some mutton and mead and a
spring in a turkey leg,
a joust.
Eat with our hands.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You got to eat with your. Yeah. Justin recently went to medieval times.
And we'll just go to. And I assume they don't have like regular bath. They just go to a bathroom in a hole.
Right.
If you're there,
like the French do.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for the call, Frank. Compare what you're hearing from Cori Bush to what you got in written word from Bob Woodson. His piece in the Journal last week, Heroes Arose from the Brutality of Slavery. We could be talking about this. We could be talking about people like Biddy Mason. And this is the genius of Bob Woodson and the civil rights era leaders like him, who saw the civil rights movement being corrupted by these black separatists, these Marxists, back then and still today. He wants to accentuate the success and the examples of black Americans so that this generation and future generations will emulate their examples. What does he always say? When whites were at their worst, blacks were at their best. That's part of the history of the country, too. Why doesn't the left want to talk about that? Why doesn't the left want kids to know anything about Biddy Mason? Because I will bet you dollars to donuts, there are fewer people who can explain what Juneteenth is. I mean, there are few people who know who Biddy Mason is than who can explain what Juneteenth is. Or who could solve a quadratic equation. Biddy Mason, born in 1818 as a slave to a Mississippi man, walked 1,800 miles to follow her slave master to California, where she successfully sued him for her freedom. As a free woman, Biddy worked as a midwife and nurse, carefully saving all she could. She used her savings to buy land in the rapidly growing city of Los Angeles. You've heard of it. She eventually became the wealthiest and most influential black American west of the Mississippi.
Good for her.
She used her fortune to fund charities and serve the poor. Stories such, and this is Bob Woodson's verbiage here I'm referencing. Stories such as Biddy Mason's taught with even reasonable competence can inspire school children of all races and backgrounds. Who wouldn't be inspired by someone who, forbidden to learn to read or write, sponsored the construction of the first black church in L.A., which has thousands of members today? Such heroes as Mason can give all of us, regardless of race, a framework for understanding our past and building our future together. They can give us the tools to reconcile with one another and discern justice in light of historical reality. Right. So why doesn't the left want to tell you about Biddy Mason or, frankly, Bob Woodson? why doesn't the left want to say, you know, did you read the Bob Woodson piece in The Wall Street Journal? Let's talk about it. Did you read White Guilt by Shelby Steele? Let's talk about it. Remember when we brought attention to I Hate White People Day at New Trier High School a few years ago?
Oh, yeah.
And they discontinued it. What was the play? And what it was my suggestion for the play against CRT everywhere it is in all these schools? Oh, you can have your Ibram Kendi and your Robin DiAngelo. No problem. I don't want to ban anything. I want to expand. You can have that as long as we include Thomas Sowell and Bob Woodson and Shelby Steele and stories of Biddy Mason and Black Wall Street in Tulsa, not just the massacre, but the entrepreneurial success before the massacre and since. and subsequent. So as long as we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion, I'm very confident that kids will be inspired, just like people listening to this, by the story of Biddy Mason and be much less compelled by the endless grievances of an Ibram Kendi. So let's put it to the test on this Juneteenth. Wouldn't that be a treat? Terry, Rogers Park.
All right. Juneteenth is a way to keep shaming white people forever.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Well,
I'm not bothered by it. I mean, you seem to have a point of contention with it being called Independence Day, Juneteenth Independence Day, but slaves were freed in 1865. Well, 2 years before, and then in 1865 in Galveston, they actually were freed. And I don't have a problem with them having a federal holiday. I don't like what I saw at some of the celebrations with the twerking and things like that. But there were some also nice celebrations because it coincided with Father's Day yesterday. So they had a 5K run on the South Side with fathers and their children. And they honored Juneteenth. And I don't see a problem with that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't like what the congresswoman out of Missouri said. Because they need to have Juneteenth.
Right. See, the problem is you can't separate the two. You don't get to say I like it because of this narrow reason. I like it if it has this narrow implication because it doesn't have that narrow implication. I like it so long as it's this. Well, it's not that. So now what do you do?
I'm not that fired up to try to abolish the Juneteenth holiday. It's here to stay.
Because why? Because it's been here for a year? No, because nobody wants to have this conversation. Nobody wants to offer the argument that I'm offering and a lot of other people are offering, too. In no uncertain terms, nobody wants to think about this in terms of its historical import, its relevance, the bastardization of it by the left, and what the end game here is. I got no problem with it. I hope it's not used for black separatism. It is being used for black separatism, but I mean, it's here to stay. Okay, maybe, probably. So when something is done, that's done. Don't care about the consequences. It's done. They did it. So it's over. We just stop. Okay. I mean, that's the attitude of most, which is why the left marches inexorably through rewriting, eliminating American history, and undermining comedy in C-O-M-I-T-Y in this country. I mean, that's a race hustle. I know. But I mean, I don't agree with that. But I agree with all of the instrumentality. I'm fine with their instrumentality. I'm fine with what they weaponize. No, I mean, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with blacks are victims and whites are oppressors. And that's just the way it is because of your skin color. Well, I mean, it's here to stay. CRT's in all the classrooms. So what are you going to do about it? I'm fine with it. I mean, I don't agree with what they're doing, but
CRT.
It's here to stay.
No,
it's in the classroom.
CRT is not here to stay.
Well, why is CRT?
In certain areas, it's already gone of the country because parents fight back.
Well, so.
How can you equate Juneteenth to CRT?
So why is CRT here to stay? Not here to stay, but Juneteenth is.
Because Juneteenth is a federal holiday honoring when slaves were free.
CRT is part of.
CRT.
CRT is part of a school curriculum. So what? It's being federalized by this Department of Education. It's being instituted statewide in places like Illinois. Why isn't it here to stay? State did it. That's it. Conversation's over.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment, one comment. Their goal is not to empower them. It's to keep them dependent. It's one of them.
Point is this. It's there to honor the freed slaves, sort of. Yes, there's a historical nexus to that statement, but that's not what the play is by those who made the play. And those mostly conservatives, who are too afraid to pump the brakes and have a more comprehensive discussion on the topic and warn of the way this would be used to divide people based on race, not to unify our country, not to do what Bob Woodson wrote about Biddy Mason, just to repeat his words. The tools to reconcile with one another and discern justice in light of historical reality. I agree with that. That's what I want. Give us the tools to reconcile with one another and discern justice in light of historical reality. Is that what Juneteenth is doing? Is Juneteenth one of those tools? Is that the sense you're getting from how it's being reported, celebrated, explained? Not the sense I'm getting. Jim in Crown Point.
You know, it's amazing how white race, when you call somebody a white racist, you meant a white person. Now, a black person can be a white racist because of how the views he espouses. The Democratic Party was able to hijack a whole culture and keep them mainly for voting rights. The latest debacle was when they tried to say black people don't have the ability to get a driver's license. Now, how racist is that?
Thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, did you see the tweet from the mayor of New Orleans, LaToya Cantrell?
What?
As Juneteenth approaches, we celebrate with an unveiling in Lafayette Square. This sculpture is very fitting for this time and place as we celebrate the freedoms that we've gained. We know that it doesn't come without struggles, fights, and protests for 200-plus years. It's a huge sculpture of a pick for your hair.
You're kidding me.
I'm not kidding.
That is so...
I mean, is that celebrating...
Oh, my God.
Is that celebrating black achievement? Black Americans who overcame the ravages of institutional racism and bondage? I mean, these are the people you want to write American history. They're pointing the way forward. They're giving us the tools to reconcile with one another and discern justice in light of historical reality. Is that how you feel on this day? I don't. Sorry.
That's insulting.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, providing a wonderful metaphor for his presidency. Joe Biden took a little bike ride this weekend, and this happened.
Hey, Dr. Biden, how was your anniversary?
I've fallen, and I can't get up.
Well, thankfully, he had life call. And so they responded immediately and picked him up, dusted him off.
Secret Service agents ran to his side and picked him up right away. But that's happened. He had his foot stuck in the cage of the pedal. At that age, just use pedals. You don't need cages because I know you're a big cyclist. But you can just have the flat pedal like you had when you were kids, you know, old school. because with his age, you know, he got stuck and he fell down and went boom.
It's really interesting because history is rhyming here. I had forgotten this.
Right.
But in 1979, Jimmy Carter didn't fall down riding his bicycle. And, you know, maybe don't have such a racing bike like Biden had. Maybe go with the girl's bike with the training wheels that Obama used to ride around in.
With the mom jeans.
Just for safety's sake.
Or get a big wheel or a green monster.
I love the green monster.
Oh, I
had a green monster.
I had a big wheel, and I rode that thing so much that the tires wore out.
Green monster was cool because it had the shift and you could spin out. In 1979, Jimmy Carter entered a 10K.
I did not know he was a runner.
Yeah.
Bush was.
But he couldn't finish it. New York Times characterized him as pale and exhausted. And there were photos of Secret Service agents holding up President Carter.
Do you picture that? A 10K is about, 6 miles, 6.5 miles?
Yeah.
You couldn't finish that?
Keep it going, Jimmy. Keep it going, Jimmy. Get ready for the next race.
Dan, if you were forced to right now, you could complete a 10K.
I could. I called out, and then...
so could I.
One of the Secret Service... give him water and fast. So, you know, we've been here before, both with... although, you know, Jimmy Carter was actually, by all accounts,
a decent person.
He is a terrible president.
Horrible president.
He was a weak leader. What you have with Joe Biden is all of that and worse, because Joe Biden is not a good person. He is a pathological liar. He's a fabulist of the First Order. And he's a international embarrassment. And again... because he's going to be okay, we can joke about his, you know, fall and go boom a little bit. But it is telling. It's something else that's telling.
Old.
Is it's getting so bad for the left that they're finally starting to acknowledge something that, most common sense Americans picked up on long ago. Like, perhaps his previous two runs for president. Certainly... his last one in 08, that he's getting up there in age.
Yeah, he's old. I mean, he looks old. Remember, don't forget March of 2021 when he fell down the stairs or walking up the stairs to Air Force One. Remember that tumble he took, and then he got up and then he tumbled again? He cannot. And Jill, you know, Jill's been protecting him and walking him on and off stage and telling him where to go. And when she's not there, he is lost.
As we saw with the phantom handshake a couple of weeks ago.
I know. I'm telling you. I remember there's a video, too, where he says, go left, during the inauguration, where somebody's talking to him in his ear, it looks like, and he's repeating what the person is saying. Shake hand here. Go left. Walk forward.
Peace in the Atlantic. Let me put this bluntly. Joe Biden should not run for re-election in 2024. He is too old.
Well, and David Axelrod came out and said that last week, too.
82 years young. Yeah, that's the point. It's the chorus of the leftist flacks who are, you know, the last ones to admit what everybody else or most everybody else knows to be true. And so all of this reporting about him running again, the president's position is he's running again, while in...
No, he can't.
Sort of openly and notoriously, you have most of the party trying to figure out who they can... engineer to replace him and how they can derail him if he were to try to run again. It's going to be difficult.
Well, the world's watching his decline, and you think Putin didn't see that?
Well, yeah. I mean, again, right. The projection of weakness, generally speaking, whether policy or just visually, is a problem. What do you say about the Biden presidency so far? What do you say about Joe Biden? What can you say about him that hasn't been said repeatedly? I just find it interesting that we can't hold out any longer. It's sort of like Brian Deese over the weekend, White House economic advisor. Yeah, we get it. Inflation is bad and it's our number one priority. Finally, sort of conceding that You had a yelling sort of apology a couple weeks ago. You had the, we didn't miss anything, but it's number one priority. Now it's, you know, yeah, we get it. We see the stickers on the gas pumps. We get it. We got to do something about it because it's a fitting to do us in as a party for the near term if we don't. But they don't know what to do. Well, whether they know what to do or not, there's not the political will to do what's required to change the economic conditions on the ground.
Well, it shows that he's, that fall to me shows that he's not well, and it makes me wonder who's running the country. Who's really in charge?
Yeah, the who's really in charge thing. Everybody. The same
the
everybody's.
Yeah.
The administrative state that's always in charge, that fills in the blanks where Congress or the executive fails to act. That's who's in charge. The new Marxists that run all these agencies, the Marxists on so many of the courts in this country. You know, who's in charge in the Oval Office? A handful of former Obama staffers, just like they were for 8 years when it was Obama who's in charge. You know, the same men and women have always in the positions that have done nothing but increase in power, you know, the power available to distribute, to impose, the will to impose. Over the last 50 years, as we've watched this federal leviathan expand beyond anyone's individual control. Certainly. Any branches control. Maybe the three branches is control, since I'm suggesting it's the fourth branch, the unidentified one, at least if you're interested in what the Constitution lays out, the administrative state.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a comment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love this. All these bike enthusiasts, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't because I despise bike riders.
I know.
Yeah.
Weekend warriors.
But we're getting all the details. New York Post talked to somebody
who said
from pictures. He's a former Trek employee. It looks like a $600 model. It's a bit old. appears the same. Had a Bont Ranger cockpit, linear pull rim brakes, and a rusty chain well past its prime. It was tricked out with a host of accessories, including a wireless computer, a coil cable lock, a bottle cage, a bento box.
A bento box.
I thought that's what you get for like lunch at an Asian restaurant. And a rear view mirror attached to the handlebars. The report took special note of one add-on, the pedal's toe cages, which you mentioned, which the big guy blamed for his fall.
Well, he was, because he's not, cognitively, you've got to know that when you put your left foot down to stop, you got to pop out that toe cage right away, or else you're going to fall down. It happens to the best of us, but he wasn't clipped in. It was the cage thing, and he should know better.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's old.
He's 79. It was a Trek FX1 disc, a lightweight hybrid bike meant for rides of varied terrain. Isn't that fascinating? God, bicycling magazine editor. Could you think of a worse way to spend your life?
We used to.
Honestly.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Did you see this about these Colbert staffers that were arrested?
Yeah, they're at they're at the Capitol, right?
Yeah, Adam Schiff. He brought them in, and nine Colbert Show staffers were busted by Capitol Police around 8:30 on Thursday night in the Longworth House Office Building. Insurrectionists.
What were they doing?
They were
trying to overturn the election.
It was a coup d'etat. They were trying to take over the government.
No,
yeah. The Colbert Show was trying to. We were this close to losing our democracy when nine Colbert staffers enter the Capitol with the treasonous Adam Schiff, and they should all be brought up on high crimes and misdemeanors. There should be a. What was the date? What was
January 6th?
No. What was this date?
Thursday
would have been June.
Hold on.
Let's say today's the 20th and
16th.
June 16th commission. We need a June 16th commission we need to get to the bottom of this in order to save our democracy. I nominate...
Who do you want to be on the committee?
Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger to do this work.
I think they have a lot of homework. They might, you know, be busy.
Adam Schiff, he snuck in Colbert's staff to the Capitol, facilitated unauthorized reconnaissance tours of GOP offices, said the House Judiciary Committee Republicans via Twitter. On the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, Schiff cronies sneak in Colbert staffers and provide unauthorized recon tours of Republican offices throughout Capitol Hill.
Was Triumph there?
Yeah, Rob Smigel was there. I do like Triumph.
For me to poop on.
I do like Triumph.
That would be actually
comedy
cool
dog.
If he was. And then I had the thing. Hey, Nancy Pelosi, like, you do the whole thing.
I assume that these Colbert staffers will be held without bail for weeks, months, years.
Oh, they
on
should
end.
Be treated as political prisoners because it was an insurrection. They're trying to take over the government, as you said.
I mean, first. I mean, they're like the Proud Boys.
Oh, you know who was there? It was the Triumph. He was in the hallways of the Capitol recording.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I know.
I said
yeah.
Rob Smigel was there. Just, you don't know who Rob's...
No, I know Triumph, though, for me.
Yeah.
Obama.
Well, that's... Yeah, okay. Well, this just in, that's Robert Smigel.
The dog never does.
It's not an actual dog.
It's not?
Yeah.
Darn it.
Actual dogs don't smoke cigars.
But they do poop on.
Uh-huh. All right, so...
Okay, well, that's all right. You know, rules for thee, but not for me.
When the
glad they got arrested.
Republicans take over Congress in November. Look forward to a Jan 16 commission to investigate this Colbert staff break-in of the Capitol, this coup d'etat attempt, so that Republicans can play the Save Our Democracy game next year.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Governor Spaulding in New Hampshire over the weekend to do some presidential feeling around.
Every time, too, when the press or we ask him about it, his face lights up like a kid in a candy store. Like, who, me? Me? No, I care about Illinois. I'm running for the governor of this fine state. I love this job.
And when you're talking about his face lighting up like he's in a candy store, I mean, that's lighting up.
I mean, no, I'm not kidding you. Lights up. Because
mm-hmm.
he wants it. You could tell he wants it so badly.
Among his accomplishments, let me read them all for you in case you haven't been keeping track. The accomplishments of one Governor Spaulding.
Is this what he touted on Saturday night in New Hampshire?
That's right.
Raising
the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Record-setting infrastructure bill. Also doubling the state gas tax.
Did you say doubling the state's gas tax?
Properly.
Infrastructure bill?
Proper handling of the pandemic.
Joke.
Comprehensive laws to fight climate change. Enshrinement of reproductive rights into Illinois law. Protecting elections. Expanding voting rights. Reforming the criminal justice system. Balancing the budget. And legalizing cannabis with the most equity-centric approach in the country.
That is a bold-faced lie, and they know it. They hardly gave any women and minority groups those dispensaries. Hardly any of them. And at one point in time, there was zero. So then they had to expand the project, and then the black community was so upset at that. Because what's her name? Lightfoot, State Senator Lightfoot. She lied to him, too. I watched them lie to the black community. It's great.
Yeah.
Front row seat to more bull jive.
It's even worse than that, of course. The idea that you are a ally of black empowerment and entrepreneurial success by distributing a few licenses to peddle dope. That's what it's come to?
Well, they mostly gave it to all their cronies, their friends.
I think you're missing the underlying point.
I know.
The idea of dope peddling being economic development and empowerment. Sad commentary on the state. Dope and gambling. And abortion
capital. Guys, we're going to get, I mean, Planned Parenthood in Wisconsin, they've canceled abortions for July that were scheduled, just whatever.
So those are...
they're all coming here.
Those are Jelly Belly's accomplishments, in his own words. Seems to me in this year that maybe you have a vulnerable incumbent governor, particularly as he's starting to measure the drapes already with respect to his presidential desires. And as Rate Days from a primary, there's some things afoot that I just wanted to direct people's attention to and perhaps disabuse them of some things. Okay. One of the things that was circulating over the weekend was an internal poll that was released by Jesse Sullivan's campaign that shows him in a statistical dead heat with Darren Bailey. No.
Yeah, I saw that as well. Is that true? I was going to ask you that today.
So here's the thing about that. It's not an accurate poll. I'm sorry, but it's just not. Here's the thing. You don't close a 25-point gap, 20 to 25-point gap, which is the spread between Bailey and Sullivan, with Irvin in second, without some sort of exogenous event that reshuffles the race, or new messaging and significant weight behind that messaging to generate reconsideration. A couple people running around saying, I'm the best to beat Pritzker, doesn't change the race, doesn't change the nature of the race, the distribution of it in any meaningful way. So it's just not credible. None of the numbers in that poll are credible. By the way, this is not the first time that this consultant who Jesse Sullivan has done this play with a late poll. J.D. Vance in the Ohio Senate race. A note to political journalists, the best pollster in the race was Tony Fabrizio. Maybe in the future, don't treat garbage polls from Remington the same as Tony's because they're both quote-unquote internal. The best independent pollster was Robert Cahaley. That's Trafalgar. Kudos to both. Tony Fabrizio is my pollster as well. Robert Cahaley, Trafalgar, we reported the poll, the independent poll that he did last week that had Bailey up 37 to 20 with Sullivan at 12, I think. Thus my point about the spread, and you don't close that kind of spread without doing a lot of messaging both directions to pull down the front runner as well as to elevate yourself, and that just hasn't happened.
And didn't Sullivan hire Youngkin's campaign staff?
The consultant's name is Jeff Rowe, okay. Who is with Ted Cruz and the presidential race. I mean, this is really inside baseball stuff. I'm just saying the poll's not accurate. And, you know, perhaps that consultant, and by the way, this was the same deal. He was with Mandel against Vance in Ohio, which is why I'm referencing this. Fabrizio was with Vance. Joe was with Roe, I should say, was with Mandel. And they did the same thing late in the thing. Oh, said, you know, it's not happening. It's close. Two things. One is you're trying to prevent a Trump endorsement. They were trying to prevent a Trump endorsement in Ohio, which is why they cooked up a poll that said it's close or Mandel was up, so that Trump says, oh, this is risky. Maybe I should just stay out of it.
Oh, I see.
That's one goal. The other goal is to get your candidate to spend more money because they make more money, even if you know your candidate's going to lose, which is not illegal. I think it is unethical, but it's not unheard of. And maybe that's going on here, too, because you have Trump coming to town, coming to Quincy this weekend.
On Tuesday. I think it's Tuesday. Honey.
No. This weekend. Mary Miller is the Republican candidate. She's been on the show running against Rodney Davis and for that that newly
right.
created
so
seat. They were drawn together.
He's coming to endorse her and have a big rally.
Right. And...
But do you think at that time he's going to endorse one of these GOP gubernatorial candidates?
I think there's a possibility he endorses Bailey at that rally.
Okay.
I would say it's more likely than not he endorses Bailey at that rally. May not, but it's more likely than not that he does. Just like I'm saying, Bailey, it's more likely than not that Bailey is going to win this race come a week from tomorrow, and it won't be that close. Could change. Still a week to go. I'm just saying more likely than not. So that's that. Just understand that's what's happening here as Sullivan people are, you know, banding about this poll to try to, you know, I guess, you know, whip some enthusiasm, some additional enthusiasm. But it's just not accurate. So, you know, believe what you want. But there's a track record here. I've explained what's happening. You can choose to believe it or not believe it.
And then Pence is coming today to speak at the University Club. Do you think he's going to make an endorsement?
I think
people care if he would.
I don't think his endorsement is relevant. I don't think it moves any votes. I mean, frankly, the only person's endorsement who moves votes in any significant way is Trump's. It's just a reality. By the way, it's the only person who moves significant dollars people's way, too, when he endorses, which if Bailey were to secure the endorsement, that's, you know, that would be
huge.
Big money. So that helps when you're going to be up against big money in a general election.
Because I know Gary Rabine has been to Mar-a-Lago more than a few times trying to get Trump's endorsement as well.
Love Gary. Sorry, Charlie Kirk. Not going to happen. I know Charlie's tried to get Trump to endorse Gary. I know Gary's tried. I understand. Absolutely, that's what you should try to do.
Yep.
Because it would benefit him. But if you are not competitive, then he's not going to make a symbolic endorsement.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Mm-hmm. Mark Maxwell, who is a downstate network affiliate political reporter for a while, he tweeted out, the Trafalgar Group has been the most accurate Republican pollster in the Trump era. If the numbers that I just mentioned, we talked about last week, hold another 2 weeks, and it looks more and more likely they will. Mark Maxwell, you know, not a Bailey supporter, not a conservative.
He's a Democrat.
Of course, he's in the media, so
right,
it's
and
redundant.
Pritzker loves him.
It looks more and more likely that those numbers will hold. Richard Irvin's loss could loom large over Jim Durkin's bid to retain his job leading the Illinois House GOP.
Oh, no, not that.
Hate
to see him go.
It's interesting. We'll see. I don't know that there's anybody in the House Republican caucus that wants the job, that could get the job. I know that the balance of power is moving away from the suburbs to downstate, which is appropriate for the Republican Party because that's where the energy is, because that's where you have conservative reform leadership. You have none in the suburbs. So why should it stay here? But whether Durkin stays the titular head of the super minority in the House or not, you should also know that another little development over the weekend is
what?
Durkin and some of these feckless combine House and Senate Republicans not fleeing.
Whoa.
Irvin.
What?
Like rats off a sinking ship, and now trying to get people, caucus members, to come over and endorse Sullivan to try to whip vote for Sullivan. It's really funny to watch and sad and telling.
I mean, you're talking about some of those lawmakers, the 60-plus who signed the sheet.
Yeah.
Dedicating their lives and their souls to Richard Irvin.
Right.
Well, are they jumping off the boat?
Well, you know, dedicating your soul to something as a Republican in this state, Republican office holder for most of these people, at least the people we're talking about.
Being flamboyant.
Yeah. I mean, this is the 30 pieces of silver caucus
right
here. So, Durkin. Yeah, it'd be interesting to know if this was green-lighted by Ken Griffin after $50 million investment in Richard Irvin and essentially whipping all these Republican whores into line for Richard Irvin. Be interesting to know if this was green-lighted. Because if it wasn't, I hope Ken Griffin is taking notice of this and recognizing the sort of thieves he put himself in business with. That he was ostensibly persuaded to put himself in business with here. And I hope that Republicans writ large are taking note of this. And by the way, I mean, you know, you're a candidate. So I would, if, you know, I'm sure Sullivan will take whatever help he can get. That's understandable. That's fine. But of course, understand who you're in bed with. Right. Lay down with dogs, wake up with fleas, rats off a sinking ship. Richard Irvin may be learning a bit of a lesson in politics in the last week as well.
The worst candidate I've ever seen in my entire life,
but
Richard Irvin.
I don't have much sympathy for these people turning on Richard Irvin because it's flim-flammers flim-flamming the flim-flammer.
Yeah, but what if they go to your candidate, Bailey?
Well, they're not going to because they're going trying to go to Sullivan. Why? Okay. Or because they have no cord with Bailey. Bailey took on one of Jim Durkin's caucus mates with my backing back 4 years ago and beat him after he voted for Rahner's income tax increase. And Bailey and those Eastern Bloc legislators like Chris Miller and Blaine Wilhauer downstate, no, they want the House Republican caucus to be conservative reform, and they're willing to take the fight to the 30 pieces of silver element within their party. And Bailey's one of them, which is why there's no chance they will come to Bailey, and nor should he want them. But that's a little bit of what's going on, just so you understand how duplicitous, how oleaginous, and unskilled, too. This is important. Unskilled and incompetent House and Senate Republican caucuses are at the leadership level. Illinois Republican Party is at the leadership level. And watch them all scurry. One sinking ship to another to another. Roland in Arlington Heights, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. I just got some campaign material from the Democrats complaining that Darren Bailey is too conservative for Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Not for me, he isn't.
Yeah, well, exactly, Roland.
Recycle it or
thanks
throw
for
it
the
away.
Call.
Get these flyers. Oof.
Kip in Stillman Valley.
Stop.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And listen, you know what? You enlighten me a little bit more on the candidates, because what I'm called about was what I had heard on Saturday morning show on Black and Right. Sullivan was on, and he had made the comment that Bailey was on Fox, and he made they were talking about school education, and I believe it was over the transgender issue, that if school boards supported that he would be behind them. But I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe you can enlighten me a little bit further, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thanks.
Thanks, Kip. Yeah, we talked about this a bit last week. Darren Bailey said, you know, he was asked to think specifically about Evanston-Skokie District 65 and the lunacy that occurs on a daily basis in that school district. And he basically said, look, you know, if a local school district wants to pursue this path with CRT or other Marxist curriculum, well, that's the local school board is within their rights to pursue it. And, you know, as somebody who believes in subsidiary power closest to the people, as somebody who was a school board member for 18 years in Clay County, that'd be Darren Bailey. These are local matters. We say this all the time. Everybody wants local control. Well, you have local control if you want to use your local control the way that Evanston-Skokie does, and the residents seem to like this.
A lot of conservatives are, you know, on Twitter and calling in. They were upset with that.
Yeah, Sullivan voters were. I saw. Okay. But here's the thing. What does Bailey say in the debates? The first thing he would do is what? Fire the state superintendent of schools.
Right.
Get control of the Illinois State Board of Education. Repeal culturally responsive teacher training, which he sponsored legislation to do, I believe. He's certainly taken the position. You know, I think the idea of following in the footsteps of DeSantis with respect to banning CRT and banning the sexualized curriculum in the primary grades is something that he's definitely supportive of. But it's going to be difficult to do that legislatively, depending on what the balance of power would look like in the General Assembly if he were to be governor. So what he's saying is, I'm going to do what I can through the State Board of Education, where I have appointment power. But you have to realize, unless you have a significant change in the composition of the General Assembly, you are not going to have the votes to do what you've seen DeSantis or Greg Abbott do. Just like we talk about, you can't do a budget repair bill the way that Scott Walker did in Wisconsin because you don't have the votes. So you provide leadership. You do what you can through the powers that are attendant to your office. and you recognize where the limitations are. It's just a pragmatic answer. For as much as people talk, oh, he's a conservative ideologue, he's actually just a pragmatic conservative reform farmer is what he is. Bill, Northwest Side.
Hey, Bill.
Hi. No, this is Mike in Justice.
Mike in Justice, Bill in Southwest Side.
The same thing,
sure.
Just a little different.
Same deal. Yeah. All right.
Sorry. Hey, nobody's really talking about the Republicans that are running for the Senate. And I had a question because I'm not sold on Peggy Hubbard at all. I'm looking at Pittman and Dubiel, but I don't know much about them. I was wondering what your take is, Dan, on that race.
Well, we had him on, all the candidates.
Thanks, Bill.
Came on.
Or Dave and Justice, or Bill on the Southwest Side, or whoever you are. Yeah.
But, I was warming up to Kathleen Salvi, but then I found out, one event she sent her campaign manager, her daughter was getting married, that's acceptable. But the other one, they had a debate, and she sent her husband. And that does not fit right. That does not feel good. And then we had her on, too, and it sounded as if she was reading off of a piece of paper. She's a lovely woman. I got to spend time with her, and I thought, okay, I'll look into your campaign, and then found out all of this, and I don't like that.
Kathy Salvi is the one who's gotten most of the conservative grassroots endorsements. The Salvis have a long track record as a family of social conservatism.
But you got to show up for your debate. You can't send your husband.
Well, yeah. I know Matt Dubiel too from the radio business. I like him.
I like his fight. He's
so
feisty.
Those would be the two candidates I would focus in on if I were contemplating the decision in that race. Phil on the Northwest Side.
I'm curious, is Bailey taking money from the Democrats on his campaign, and also did Pritzker endorse him?
No and no. Thanks for the call, Phil.
How much has, because somebody asked, my dad asked me this yesterday, how much money do you think Pritzker has spent on, slamming Bailey and Irvin, like doing those truthful testimonials?
I can't remember what the last count is. Pritzker spent about...
How much?
$20 million in the primary so far. But remember, a lot of that is also positive ads. In fact, most of it is positive ads for him. The combination of him plus the DGA is probably, $25 million. I mean, all in, the guy that still had and spent the most money is Richard Irvin. We'll see what it brings him on
A
week from tomorrow, June 28th.
Oh, my.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Since President Trump is coming to town to rally for Mary Miller in her congressional race against
Rodney Davis,
a proponent of the January 6th Star Chamber, by the way, which is a big issue in that race.
Rodney Davis?
Yep, Mary Miller with Trump's endorsement. Be interesting. Interesting to see what the reshaped Republican Party may look like after next Tuesday. But since he's coming to town, I thought this was an interesting offering from Scott Adams, the Dilbert cartoon creator. Written books. He sort of came to some renown in political circles when he started sort of talking about and distilling what he sees as the genius almost of Trump's communication and why he thought Trump would be successful in 2016. He was one of the first who sort of appreciated that his communication style was resonating, and he thought Trump was going to win, which of course he was right. Scott Adams doesn't want Trump to run for president this next go around, though. He wants him to defer to Ron DeSantis for the job of being the executive, because he's got a bigger job for Trump.
What's that?
His bigger job for Trump is to fix the media. Fix the media.
The media hates him.
Here's Scott Adams.
Let me tell you how Trump could fix everything. Why is the news cycle broken such that people want to click on fake news instead of real news? Why do people like fake news instead of real news? Why? Why? It's more interesting. Right? Now, it agrees with them and gives them a dopamine hit. But it's also just wildly more interesting. So I would click on something that wasn't in my favor, like, you know, didn't support my point of view. I would definitely click on it if it was really provocative. Like, I'll click on anything provocative.
And so he suggests that Trump have a news program where he gets experts, quote-unquote experts, from the left and the right, and he dusts both sides up. And it's a long-form format. So think of like a Rush Limbaugh show, 3 hours, and it's just Trump, and it's Trump and, you know, in his appeal, his, I guess, charisma, whether they say it, that brings people to the table, and both left and right, and then he has a go at left and right, and he reshapes the news this way, fixes the news, and fixes the country by extension, because Scott Adams argues until you fix the news, that's exactly what he's giving you an indication of what he means, until you fix the news, you can't fix the country. And so this is a bigger job, and were he able to reshape the news landscape, then he would reshape our politics, improve our country, and be a national hero, at least among many, as a result. That's the bigger job. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Do you agree with him?
I mean, I'm not sure what the innovation here is. It sounds like resuscitating Crossfire, but instead of two interrogators, there's just Trump. You know, instead of like Kinsley and Buchanan, there's just Trump, and then there's the opposite side, the competing sides. I mean, I agree with his, like, the idea of all media being so siloed because the left won't engage with the right. I agree that's a problem. I agree that you should have something that is long form so you can get beyond the top lines or beyond the you're wrong, no, you're wrong, now we got to go to a break. So I agree with that. I just don't know, first of all, if a 3-hour format where Trump plays the moderator.
Will he have the patience for that?
Yeah, I don't know that that's, I don't
it's
know that that would be
suit.
His, yeah, that would be
he's the Barker
wheelhouse for him. And I don't necessarily know that you're going to get any more compliance from quote-unquote experts or thought leaders on the left than anybody else is able to get from them. I mean, how many men and women of the left go on any of these? Think about the most highly rated programs, Tucker Carlson's program. Very few, unless they're sort of converted leftists or they're aligned on a particular issue. Yeah, Tulsi Gabbard is a socialist, but she'll come on to talk about how the left has gone too far on critical race theory or this or that. But she's in agreement with the topic that they're discussing, generally speaking, with Tucker. So you don't get that back and forth. I don't know. I mean, here, listen to Adams lay it out.
Okay.
Now, what is it that Trump could do that nobody's ever done with straight, unbiased reporting?
Well, there's no such thing.
Think about it.
That's the first problem.
The reason that nobody wants a straight, unbiased reporting is that nobody would watch it. Am I right? If you gave me just the news, nobody will watch it. So it's not a business model that can work. What is the one thing that Trump, alone among maybe anybody, could fix? He could make you watch the news. And he could also make sure you heard both sides. And he could also take his time. Imagine if he took a Rush Limbaugh 3 or 4 hour block every day and had on experts from both sides and then just dusted them both up. So basically, instead of experts, instead of having, let's say, one expert just give their opinion, which is the worst model in the world, that's how it's currently being done. It's mostly just one person says one thing, or there's a time limit, and the two experts say, you're wrong, we're out of time, so the public got nothing. But you give me a 3 or 4 hour block, doesn't have to be every day, it could be recorded and, you know, just when there's a good topic to do, and you have Trump beating up both sides and calling bullshit on both sides.
Bull jive.
I could not turn away from that. That would be so provocative and interesting, especially if you allowed swearing. If you allowed swearing and let Trump mediate and interrupt and, you know, and just sort of control it so it would be maddeningly, frustratingly beautiful. It would be maddening and frustrating and beautiful.
It would be the Morton Downey Jr. show.
Yeah.
That's what I hear him saying, because, and I mean, I don't think Trump is as bombastic as he is in some sense. I mean, it's nothing like what the Morton Downey Jr. show, and that thing went up like a Roman candle. And
it's,
you know,
crazy to watch. It was crazy,
but it was a crazy show. And he was a huckster. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. It's just what he was. But
so it wouldn't be that.
I don't.
But a lot of people take point of contention with his Adams idea because they want him, President Trump, to run in 2024.
Well, I know, but what about this idea?
Okay.
You know, if let's say he didn't want to, say his choice, he didn't want to. What about this idea? Trump is like, he has good instincts. He knows, generally speaking, where we should end up. He doesn't always have the details of the path to get there worked out such that he has a very specific handle on them. This is where he's different than, this is where DeSantis is different than him. DeSantis is very much hands-on. He's very much hands-off, and sort of power of personality will get him to where he wants to go, I think, more so. But the other thing about this, first of all, the whole, like, unbiased news. Okay, there's no such thing. Just stop it. Number one. Number two, people won't watch it. I disagree. You know who could fix the news? I mean, if you followed the model that she uses.
Who?
Cheryl Atkinson.
Yeah.
Cheryl Atkinson, who's an actual investigative reporter. The packages that she puts together are very good. They're very tight, but they're long enough so that you get some texture and you get some handle on the issues. She does get multiple sides. And I hate that both sides, as if there's only two sides. She gets multiple viewpoints on a particular topic that she's tackling. I don't know that she can moderate for 3 hours, and that would be interesting. But in terms of a news product that people would watch that is contextual and consequential, those are the phrases, that the words that pay, the phrase that pays for me. Contextual and consequential. That's why people don't watch the news. Not because it's not provocative, titillating is essentially what Adams is suggesting, which I totally disagree with. It's because it's not substantive. It doesn't have any meaning to my life. Yeah. How many times have I said, you know, kitchen fire or crack up on the Dan Ryan? That's terrible to the person that it happened to. I'm sorry, but it has no meaning in my life. I don't want to watch 30 minutes of that and then stale sports scores and somebody pointing at a weather map. I don't want to watch that. But I will watch a package that Cheryl Atkinson puts together on the border. And, that to me is good reporting. And if we had more of that, if her full measure could be scaled and emulated, that starts to change conversations because it builds bigger communities around that sort of substantive content. I'm all in agreement for a firing line, and the firing line that's up now with Margaret Hoover as the host is a affront to the legacy of William F. Buckley and the real firing line. That's a joke. She's terrible. That program is unwatchable because she's not particularly knowledgeable and she is not a particularly good interviewer. She's the antithesis of William F. Buckley. Should be ashamed of themselves for resuscitating that under that title. But something like a longer form crossfire, something like a firing line, there's absolutely, I think, a appetite for it. But, you know, you have to have thought leaders from all sides, shall we say, willing to participate. And you just don't, with few exceptions, on the left. That's the problem. In addition to some of who we place our hopes and dreams in on the right, who are frankly not particularly knowledgeable either. And we on the, as conservatives, speaking for my opinion about it, we should do a better job separating people who know what they're talking about from people who know some of the lines to recite. Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I think Scott Adams was kind of making the case against having Donald Trump do it towards the end. I don't know about you, Dan. I think I have a pretty good idea about you a little bit, though. But you know, what I like to do on weekends sometimes is watch the old firing lines with William F. Buckley and Thomas Sowell go at it with people, and Howie or the Saul Alinsky interview, or Free to Choose with Milton Friedman, or some of the old videos on YouTube where you would see Malcolm X face off against some of the reporters from Chicago and see how real intellectual people argue their cases in a controlled and substantive manner.
Just Charles Ogletree, the Harvard Law professor, who we hosted that roundtable discussion, those roundtable discussions on PBS, too. I'm forgetting the name of the program now, but I used to watch those as well. I mean, I thought there were too many people. Ogletree was a good moderator. Too many people. So the conversation sort of went on a lot of tangents and got diluted. But that kind of concept. Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about that. Free to Choose, firing line. That's part of an education. What program can you point to today, other than ours, of course, and say that is part of educating you on a daily basis? I can't point to any. Maybe Prager.
I will say this really quickly. I think your Cheryl Atkinson suggestion is excellent. I didn't think of it. The other thing is, and not just to blow your own horn, I think that when you ran your overnight show and you had the guests you had on, you laid the groundwork for something like that. James A. Lindsay's, Matt Taibbi's, Glenn Greenwald, Dr. Faridi. I think that's what we need. Now, whether you can do it or Cheryl Atkinson can do it or somebody else can do it, I think that's what we need. But Donald Trump and the Scott Adams analogy, it doesn't work. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Will Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? I think that Brett Baer tried something kind of like this recently with his debate between Bernie Sanders and Lindsey Graham. I wouldn't have put Lindsey Graham up for our side. I would put someone like Ted Cruz up for our side. But what, you don't agree? Lindsey Graham was not good?
No, I agree with you, yes.
Yeah. You know, and the thing that I liked about watching that was Lindsey kind of held his own, but he was spouting more the party line, whereas Bernie Sanders was actually laying out the ideology. And, you know, it was just nothing but 1950s, you know, communist ideology.
Right.
And but having that stuff out there, the problem is I don't think you're going to get a lot of people on the left who will come in, because leftist ideology pretty much is self-contradictory, especially when you get into wokeness and transsexualism and all this other stuff. It's a good thing. And I think, in my opinion, Brett Baer is probably one of the most straightforward, honest guys out there. He tries to stay in his own lane, and he tries to go right down the middle, and he doesn't make it about him. You know, he makes it about bringing out the other people. And so I think something like that would be very good.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Will. Tom, Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. And let's not forget that Bill Buckley was the guy with the passion that threatened to punch Gore Vidal right in the nose.
Yes,
so,
and he'll stay plastered.
More than just an educated man.
Yeah.
Trump would be, after 5 minutes, Trump would be bored. I believe this is another attempt by a Scott Adams type to try to deter Trump, who will be running in 2024 and win. And then hopefully we get 8 years of DeSantis after that.
All thanks. Right. Tom, thanks.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A majority of chief executive officers and C-suite leaders across the globe believe a recession will find us before the end of next year. 60% of CEOs surveyed by Conference Board, a business research firm, found they expect the economy to contract in their primary area of operations in the next 12 to 18 months. Some 15% say they believe their region has already entered a recession. What does Jim Urio believe? Jim Urio, Fox Business analyst and proprietor of Brandt and Palatine, joins us now. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. So that's the question. What do I believe? I certainly believe that they are correct. I think that I don't know that we're in a recession already, but you already look at a couple things, particularly with just if we teased out housing, the numbers in the last 2 weeks, as far as mortgage applications going down, houses on the market going up, the number of houses that have lowered their prices has increased dramatically. So something's definitely changing very quickly. Now, the indicator that we always look at is 2s versus 10, the yield curve, because it's a predictor of a recession coming. It's 85% effective over the last 150 years, if you want the statistics on it. So the 2s versus 10s, 2-year yield versus 10-year yield, has gone to zero, basically, meaning that the market thinks that there's a recession coming, meaning that people want to park their money in longer-term bonds instead of taking risks. So all these things, remember that once the ball starts rolling and this kind of talk is happening about recession, then people start to be a little more cautious, and then it becomes self-fulfilling. So I think that there's very little chance that we're going to get out of this in the next 6 months without a recession. Now, to determine if that recession is going to be deep and long is about energy policy, in my opinion. Either there's a 180 pivot in our government about energy policy, or else we have to be ready for kind of a long slog.
Well, on that topic, listen to what California Representative Ro Khanna had to say on CNBC on Friday in response to this question that's being put to Biden and all of his allies like Representative Khanna, which is, you want more oil while you want to eliminate the oil companies. So, you know, help us understand how you think that's possible.
And I think we want refineries to be able to pump out more gasoline right now, because that's part of the problem. We don't have the refinery capacity. But those are not investments that businesses are going to make if we are telling them this is for the short term. We want them to spend billions of dollars to make additional investments that, by the way, we don't want those investments to continue producing a decade from now. It doesn't make financial sense. There are consequences when you say you don't want things over the long haul. Businesses stop spending CapEx, and that's what the oil companies have done. It's a little disingenuous to say we want you to produce short term, but then we're going to take away your ability to make money off those investments, those major investments we've asked you to make.
Well, Becky, I think that's not what the position of the party is. The position is that we want to diversify. Look, if the oil companies had been honest about global warming and had diversified since the 1970s, we would have had much more stable prices.
It's oil companies' fault.
What about that, Jim? They're not looking to put the oil companies out of business, even though that's what Biden campaigned on. They just want them to diversify their portfolio a bit. And, hey, if they don't do it now, that's on them, because they should have done it 50 years ago.
I can't follow that logic. I was hoping that you could explain it to me. Chevron CEO Mike Wirth spoke about 2 weeks ago saying that there's never going to be another refinery built in this country. In order to build a refinery, you have to have a 10-year outlook on profit, like was just said in that. And without that, they don't want to put them out of business. I can show you 20 different clips that explain very, very explicitly that they do want to put them out of business, unless those were just campaign lies, but it doesn't seem so. And if they were, they got to start pivoting and being more warm and gentle to the oil companies right now. It's absurd. And remember, like 3 short months ago, during the same week, they debated a bill to limit access to capital markets for any fossil fuel companies. And then toward the end of that week, they made individual calls to them asking, why aren't you guys pumping more oil? So I don't know. I don't think it is an affair. It's just run-of-the-mill incompetence. I don't think they understand how any of this works.
Well, the 6 oil refineries are offline right now because of the hostile situation between the Biden administration and the oil companies, said they're environmentally not up to code. So the question is our only hope in 2024 if we get a Republican president back in the White House?
It seems so. And again, I try to, I'm a trader and an analyst and try to not be on any sort of political side at all. But just from the oil discussion, we need less expensive oil if we want to have an economy that's not flirting with recession for years. So if that's the only hope, that's the only hope. I'm hoping that in this coming election, enough pro-energy people win, Republicans, whatever, and that they pivot and start speaking a little differently and start being a little more warm and welcoming. And I think I'm not even sure people will believe them. I guess what you're saying is correct. That's what I believe.
Here's the thing, too. What you see happening is these fashionable opinions, mainly held by the left, have run into reality now. And so Germany will restart coal-fired power plants and offer incentives for companies to curb natural gas consumption because Russia is slowing the supply to Europe. In Australia, Resource Minister Madeleine King wants coal-fired power station operators to get moving on fixing their plants to ease the nation's energy crisis, the same things you're hearing from the administration here. So you're the bête noire of Western civilization. You're destroying the planet. You need to be eradicated, and now you need to get moving and fix your stuff so that we can keep people warm and power our economies.
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing is that, and I was talking about this with some oil analysts the other day, the way over-aggressive energy policy that was supposed to switch us to green energy is going to end up actually delaying any sort of green energy revolution by decades, because pendulums tend to swing both ways. And they tried to do it too quickly, where there's not an infrastructure, there's not the technology that was going to pick up the slack from fossil fuels, and they pushed it anyway. And by doing so, I think they really shot themselves in the foot. And that's depressing to me. I'm actually, you know, everyone who thinks conservatives, like somehow liberals have the environmental issue and conservatives don't, understand that conservation is right in the name there. If you ever have to go to a Ducks Unlimited meeting or some with hunters who want to preserve wetlands, there's a ton of people on my side, which I didn't even know I was on a side, who are environmentally conscious. And this is going to hurt the environment, in my opinion.
All right, what about the 401ks? I know, I think last time we talked, I made the mistake of looking at it. But then you have a lot of elderly friends who are on fixed incomes who rely on their retirement, and they don't want to go through what they went through back in 2008. Is there any advice you have? Well, okay.
I thought from the beginning that that stock market was going to come off 20%. I think it just had to as a normal adjustment to a new interest rate policy. If interest rates were going higher, then the stocks, by definition, money has to find where it's treated the best. So by definition, the stocks would not be as valuable if you can get a safe rate that's higher. Now that the rates are going up a little higher than I thought, I've changed that to maybe 30%. But again, we closed on Friday down 23%, down 24%. I fully believe that the worst of this is mostly over, and I fully believe that every once in a while you have to pull liquidity out of the system and trim the hedges, so to speak, to make a stronger market. It's the timing of it is terrible, and it's very sad sometimes when people who are living in a fixed income need that at the moment, and they happen to be at the time where the market corrects like it is. But I think we're mostly through it, and I think by the end of the year we won't be down. I don't think we'll be positive on the year, but I don't think we're going to be down more than 10%.
Let me make a statement about Bitcoin and get your reaction. Bitcoin is not an inflation hedge. It's highly correlated to the NASDAQ. What you're seeing happen now is some forced sell-off, but you get valuations that are reverting to the mean for a market-correlated asset. So Bitcoin is affected by high inflation, high interest rates, a slowing economy like any other market-correlated asset. So it's not that crypto is going to go away. It's that we're starting to get a price that's more reflective of traditional market forces.
That's what I believe. I still believe that there's a place for Bitcoin particularly. And to underscore your point, too, of the things that have happened in the last few months, and that's the stable coin going under the peg, the Celsius network thing. So some of the off-brand coins just getting absolutely pummeled, and it's pulled the whole crypto space down and forced a lot of forced liquidations. But during that time, Bitcoin has actually gained its cap in the whole crypto space. I think it's close to 45% now. So I think when everything shakes out, and the crypto going down, it, like you said, it's NASDAQ, everything going down is because we have entered a period where we're pulling liquidity out of the system instead of pumping it in like we did aggressively for the last 12 years. So anything that was valued on, you know, sort of greater fool theory, meaning trading above where there's any kind of fundamental argument to be made for that's the price, when liquidity comes out of the system, then we pull back down. So that's what we're seeing right now. So I think it's interesting because people are acting like, you know, Bitcoin trading at 19,000 is the same as Bitcoin trading at zero, and that seems far from that. It's had pullbacks of 80% several different times. So it's very, very fashionable to say, see, it was, you guys were all stupid. Bitcoin is stupid. I'm not convinced of that yet, and I'm using the opportunity to add small. And again, I'm not one of those diamond hand hodlers. I'm very, very intrigued by the concept and the technology, but it's got to smooth out these 80% swings in price before anyone respects it as a store of value.
Last week in our conversation with Steve Moore, talking a little bit about the implications for the jobs number that the Biden administration still likes to bandy about to say, look, we still have a strong jobs market, historically low unemployment, and this is their way to try to direct attention away from inflation, other than to say, yeah, we know it's a problem, we're working on it. Steve said, told us that he expects that the June jobs report, or maybe the May jobs report, will be the last good jobs report we see for some time because of where things are trending. Do you see that happening as well, where you're going to start seeing that unemployment number tick up as companies are holding pat or even reducing workforce?
I'd say one more month before we start to see the declines, because anecdotally you're starting to hear it now, different companies exploring layoffs or actually laying off. But I think that we were still in a really good and red hot job market. Those are the kind of things, like asset prices, like stocks and bitcoins, they adjust quickly to market conditions because it's, you know, liquidity thing. But things like real estate, it takes people in a market that's not like open and trading. It takes people a while to realize that the changes are happening.
Right.
The job market, I'm not sure if this is a good metaphor for that, but the job market's the same sort of thing. You know, they've been operating under the belief that we need people, we need to fill these spots. It's hard to change people's minds so quickly. So in a world where we're used to seeing the ripple of change quickly, it might go a little slower there. So I'd give it another couple months.
He is Jim Urio. He's analyst for Fox Business. He's the proprietor of Brandt's Restaurant in Palatine. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Seeing as we are in the high holy month of Pride, it's always good to hear from teachers around the country. And thankfully, we have Libs of TikTok to make sure that we see what teachers around the country are posting on social media. This is from a preschool teacher reading from a book that she reads to her preschool children, promoting trans.
Looking for a way to talk to your kids about being transgender, non-binary, or even cisgender? Check out my new video. You might feel like a boy. You might feel like a girl. You might feel like both boy and girl, or like neither. You might feel like your gender changes from day to day, or from year to year. You might feel that none of these words describe you perfectly. You might not be sure yet. Maybe you're still figuring it out. Your feelings about your gender are real. Listen to your heart. No matter what your gender identity is, you are okay exactly the way you are, and you are loved. It feels good to be yourself, doesn't it?
I liked what you tweeted out over the weekend, Amy, this good-looking girl who posted a photo when she was a little girl playing football.
Yeah, it came from Matt Walsh's blog. It said, from ages 4 to 12, I wore boy clothes, played with boy sports, and rejected all things girly. When my brother teased me for being a girl, I even said that when I got older, I would cut my boobs off. I was not transgender. I just idolized my brother, and thank God my parents were sane. And it's a picture of her because she used to play football, and she, you know, she looked like a tomboy.
Yeah.
And actually looks like she's transitioning in her own way back then, and not what she's become today, which is a lovely young lady.
Yeah.
And so that's just, you know, her parents didn't give in to her tomboy routine, because there's a lot of tomboys out there. I mean, I was one too. I didn't take it to this degree to play football, but you know, and they didn't feed into it. It was just a phase we went through.
Jordan Peterson, writing on the topic. Jordan Peterson, you know, was in academia. I don't know where he would be welcome back these days. The Hippocratic Oath has been replaced by a delusion, a belief that can be summarized as, by blocking the puberty of children and then surgically altering them, we are only restoring what is theirs by right. A child's feelings are the final arbiters of their reproductive destiny, and any attempt to contest their gender identity risks increasing their proclivity for suicide. Yeah, that's a good summary of what they're arguing. And he characterizes that summary as lies, 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 then butchery. For a more on the topic of opposing the cultural orthodoxy, even in this high holy month of pride, pleased to be joined by Samuel Abrams, professor of politics at Sarah Lawrence College, the alma mater of One Tiny Dancer, former mayor of Chicago.
Well, he was a good dancer.
Visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute as well. Professor Abrams, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I believe he's now ambassador to Japan.
Right,
but who would think that being a ballerina would translate into being a politician? You know, I mean, is that the only time in our lifetime that you've seen a person who studied, you know, the ballet and performed it become a mayor of a major city?
I think in his case, he actually has said on a number of occasions he became a ballet dancer so he could meet women. But I think he'd always been a politician. I think that was sort of his family legacy. And I think he's very proud of the fact that he was looking to meet folks by taking the dance classes.
Yeah.
When he was back at Sarah Lawrence.
Yeah. Good spin, speaking of the politician exactly. Angle.
Hey-o.
So you penned this piece, some survey research about high school kids. They value free speech in the abstract, but are uncomfortable speaking up, partly because I suspect they've been getting hardwired starting in preschool by the teachers to have a certain viewpoint on issues that are much in controversy, though they wouldn't necessarily know it if they don't consume content outside of the walls of K-12 school systems.
Yeah, so it's that, and it's also the fact that we are watching the cancel culture movement, the woke movement, the progressive mobs, the silencing, the threatening, leave higher education. You know, this is something I had started warning people about almost 8-9 years ago. And unfortunately, it's jumped the leafy campus gates, if you will, and it's pervaded everywhere. So we see it in K-12. We see it in law firms. We see it in medicine. Take a look at what's going on in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's unfortunately pervading into every crevice of our society. And what's really very scary, especially with your lead-in, is that some of these ideas and some of the brainwashing and some of the silencing and forced bullying and mob-like, you know, dynamic is now taking over not just high schools, but, you know, kids who are 5, 6, and 7. I have a 4-year-old. I you know, in that lead-in, I don't want to talk to him about what's between his legs. I want to just be supportive and loving. And we'll talk about gender and sexuality later when it's time. Not time yet.
Yeah, you know, the Knight Report, which you cite in your piece about the attitudes of high schoolers toward free speech, I mean, it's sort of encouraging. It's not really. I'm not even talking about the numbers about unwillingness to speak out or uncomfortable speaking their mind. I'm talking about even those who start from the premise of being supportive of free speech. I mean, it's a majority, but it's not where it should be, which is, you know, 100%.
Right. No, it's not a majority. I'm still hopeful because when I have a chance to meet students, you know, from K-12. Graduate school and, you know, college and beyond, they all tell me the same thing. They all realize this is a problem. They all are looking for people who will, you know, put themselves out there to take the brunt of the mob. And, you know, high school students are figuring themselves out. We all have been in high school at one point. They're scared. They don't know who they are. They're trying to test the waters. They're afraid to make a mistake. I've seen in high schools now and in college that if a student asks the wrong question in the wrong way, it's not just viewed as, oh, he or she was asking a question. This person must be evil. This person must be punished. Those words should never have been uttered from this kid's mouth. And they're petrified. So the numbers are nowhere near where they should be. But the good news is that there is more pushback today than there's been in the last 5 years. Parents are realizing it. Some teachers are realizing it. Certainly, the zeitgeist in America is realizing it. And the data is showing that Americans have little patience and tolerance for this. We just need to organize to push back hard and fast.
What about students themselves? I mean, as CRT spreads across this country, are any of the kids, you know, and I know they're young and they don't know how to really advocate for themselves, but are any of them saying, gross, and I don't want to learn about this, and why in the world are we even discussing it in the first place?
Many, many, many are, believe it or not. Obviously, someone, you know, who's 4, 5, or 6 can't advocate for themselves that way. It's not possible, which is why it's so dangerous and, in my view, irresponsible of schools and teachers to be doing this. But we certainly see this in high school. There's a group in New York where I am called Next Gen Politics, where we have hundreds of students doing that. And it's growing. And, you know, it's growing because students immediately resonate with it. They want the time to think. They want the time to ask questions. They don't want to be forced into a narrow set of choices and to be told what to think and how to think. And, you know, I've watched this grow over the last 2 to 3 years, and I am optimistic because if we don't push back and we don't nurture the pushback, you know, we're going to have a very, very scary world in a few years.
Well, you know, and it seems to me you have to have more employers also push back. I mean, I don't hold out a lot of hope for colleges and universities, but employers, I do, because, you know, when a kid sees that, it doesn't have to be a celebrity, but it includes celebrities. A celebrity gets held up for ridicule and cancellation because of something they tweeted when they were 12 or something like this. Mm-hmm. Then you can understand what a chilling effect that has, and how people are afraid to wade into any area of controversy. If employers start, you know, sending messages to their employees, their Gen Z employees, that, you know, look, you're entitled to your opinions, but pump the brakes here. We're not going to do witch hunts based on people who disagree substantively on matters and controversy. There's been a little bit of that, but I mean, there needs to be a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, Netflix is a great example of that, saying it's not up to you employees to tell us what content. People can choose their own content and choose to react to it as they see fit. And I think that's encouraging. I agree. It is not happening fast enough. But the thing I always like to say, and the professor had on, is that these movements take time. This progressive woke cancel culture mob, whatever you want to call it, didn't happen overnight. It may look like it happened overnight, but this thing was brewing for almost 2 decades on college and university campuses. I watched it happen. Yeah. I tried to sound the alarm bells. People didn't take it as seriously. Then, you know, once it hit a tipping point, boom, look at what happened. We see the pushback. There are faculty groups, there are student groups, there is, quite frankly, advocacy and organizing money behind all of this. Mm-hmm. And I'm very optimistic about what we saw at Netflix, and I'm very optimistic about the marketplace of ideas and that we're going to see pushback, but it's only been, you know, a year or so. It may take another couple of years to really push back this, sadly, but it's going to happen.
You've been in higher ed for a while. What's the quality of the student you're seeing at Sarah Lawrence from, say, a generation ago in terms of their aptitude, reading, writing, reading comprehension, critical thinking? Have you seen a significant fall off, or are you still getting students that are ready to go at Sarah Lawrence?
So I actually think it's gotten better. I actually attribute a lot of the trouble to the millennial class. This is a class that mobs folks. These folks are now the youngest cohort. They're in their mid to late 20s. These are the ones that are speaking out in the workforce and the ones that are promoting the cancel culture from, you know, the colleges to places like Apple and publishing houses. What I've noticed among the Gen Zers, and this is something that you can just feel when you talk to them, is that they've had enough. They read. They have so much inbound media that they know how to think through it. They know there's a lot of noise. They know there's a lot of garbage, and they look for the truth. I am optimistic that the slightly younger generation in college is actually better prepared to deal with this and pushing back on the extreme wokeism, which I think is actually being spearheaded by folks in their late 20s, early 30s. And incidentally, these are the teachers and the administrators now who are pushing this in the schools. Same age cohort, same group of people.
Well, that's encouraging. Yeah. All right.
Yes. So there's a and I hope I'm hope. Right. I really hope I'm right.
All right. Well, I want to end on a happy note. Okay. So, yeah. Samuel Abrams, professor of politics at Sarah Lawrence, visiting scholar at American Enterprise Institute. Sam Abrams, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, it's getting a little chippy already.
What?
It's getting a little chippy.
Wait, chippy? What's chippy mean?
Your former colleague here, Steve Cochran.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a former Brother in Sound. He worked at the station for 2 years, 3 years.
Explain that. I thought this was a conservative talk radio station. What was Steve Cochran doing here? Makes no sense. But I don't understand most of the decisions that are made in politics and media. I just point them out. But anyway, I guess Steve Cochran this morning took a shot at me. He was on with this guy. He had this guy, Patrick Finkstein, on who you've never heard of until now, and you'll never hear of again. So don't even worry about it.
Okay.
And they were talking Illinois politics, and he's doing the same thing the Tribune is doing, because that's that cutting edge conservative talk radio over there, WLS. Repeat Tribune headlines back to the audience and say, what do you think?
Well, they went from they brought the whole staff from WGN over to WLS.
Sure.
No, I mean, everybody, even the.
Oh, it's great. Easy listening for octogenarians. Yeah, exactly. Hey, you know, soft talk.
Okay, well, here it is.
It's like, no.
Okay, well.
It's like yacht talk over there.
Yacht?
So they're talking about the Illinois governor's race, and the Tribune headline today is, how far right will the Illinois GOP go? Oh my gosh, it's so frightening. And this is what they're going to do. How far right will the Illinois GOP go?
Well, they'll say that you can't, take away abortion rights and blah, blah, blah.
This is scary. This is caricaturing. This is the hysteria inducing. This is what they have. This is all they have. So this is what they do. And nobody should understand it any differently, because you've seen it play out over and over and over again. As I try to remind people who have very short memories, Bruce Rauner and his wife were, you know, silver circle donors to Planned Parenthood. When he ran for governor, he's Hitler, trying to take away women's rights. He's killing women and he's killing children. It's just what they do. It doesn't matter. So have the gumption to stand up for yourself and tell people who you are and what you believe and why you believe it, rather than running from their character assassination. But you see, you know, room temperature intellects don't quite grasp that. So here's the exchange between these two dizzying intellects on WLS this morning.
You know, there's a far right wing morning show host that likes to run some PAC money with you know, firms of billionaires that like to.
Is he still on the air?
I don't know. Are they on the air?
Right,
I think it's run by a hamster. So
we'll fix that. What do you think? Steve Cochran's going to get rid of us? We're coming for you.
I will put the ratings and revenue of this show up against that dim-witted tub of vanilla pudding anytime. And if they were relevant, I'd invite them on this show. But frankly, it's better that they do their glorified ham radio program for those octogenarians that miss Orion Samuelson and had no place to turn after he passed. But I love the chippiness. I like getting into it.
I love Steve Cochran. I've been friends with him for years. He's going to get rid of us now? He's coming for us?
Well, fine. I mean, that's
we can have a.
I like it.
We can have a golf tournament.
It's competition. No, I like
it. We'd smoke him. Well, no,
I mean, it's not competition, but I mean, I like the fact that he's trying to compete with us and he wants to draw us in. You know, as Val Kilmer famously said to Johnny Rango, I'll be your Huckleberry, Steve. Yeah. Oh, if we weren't friends, I just don't think I could bear it. Tub of vanilla pudding.
All right.
You want to dip your spoon in that over at WLS? Go ahead.
just the re.
No, I like it. I like it. Let's go. Well, let's. You want to mix it up? Let's mix it up. I mean, come on.
I think we should take it out on the golf course.
Come up with better witticisms than this. You know, this guffawing to some clown that nobody knows talking far right wing. Why am I far right wing? I'm conservative. Oh, it's far right wing. We have to, because we. I'm a crypto conservative.
You're an insurrectionist.
I'm an insurrectionist. I'm an.
Even though you were here January 6th.
I mean, it's just whatever. Yeah. It's whatever. Why can are they ever challenged to defend those caricatures? Never, except here. It should be. So come on, let's have at it. Well, maybe we could do a crosstalk with
Stephen Andrea
Jelly Belly Jr. and who's with him?
It's on a tryout basis. Andrea Darlis.
I don't. Well, who's that?
You don't know who she is?
No.
She's nice.
Is she from WGN?
Yeah, it's the same morning show from WGN. They literally lifted it and they moved a few blocks away.
And Spike O'Dell?
Plunked it down.
Is Spike O'Dell?
No, Spike's not.
Is he doing middays?
He's retired. No.
No? He's not coming back?
No, he's not coming back.
Took the money and run. Smart guy.
Yeah.
Smart guy. Wish I was ahead of the learning curve. Smart, and he landed in the right place, too. See, that was back when WGN had some people with firing synapses. Or WLS, for that matter. Those days are gone.
All right, coming up on Chicago's Morning Answer.
The clownfish may be yanked out of the pool based on these new regs regarding trans swimmers, 838.
But now let's head straight into that newsroom. Here is Mike Scott.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Seriously? It's not dude looks like a lady, though.
It's more lady looks like a dude. That's what we got going on here, right? Swimming's world governing body, FINA, said yesterday they are moving to restrict the participation of trans athletes in elite women's competitions, create a working group to establish an open category for them in some events as part of its new policy. How does that work?
That means a transgender group. That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, an open category. It didn't say trans category. What does that mean? Like if men or women want to swim against the trans, they... I mean, I don't know. They don't know. They're just creating a working group. So I don't know what they don't know what the policy is. But except for this, the policy, which takes effect today, require transgender competitors to have completed their transition by age 12 to be able to compete in women's competitions. And then they're going to spend the next 6 months to set up the new open category. The spokesman for the association said... it's not saying that people are encouraged to transition by the age of 12. It's what the scientists are saying, that if you transition after the start of puberty, you have an advantage, which is unfair. They're not saying everyone should transition by age 11. Oh, thank you. That's ridiculous. You can transition by that age in most countries, and hopefully you wouldn't be encouraged to do it. But basically, what they're saying is that it's not feasible for people who have transitioned to compete without having an advantage. Please see Leah Thomas. I'm saying that.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA. Then a quick question. Why just not eliminate it altogether? Why have to set this age of 12? Because I do, regardless of what they say, I think this is going to encourage people to do it before they hit puberty to make the change.
Well, you also have this. I mean,
am I being too fuddy-duddy here?
But no, I
just, you know, now we have
fuddy-duddy. Yeah,
we have
an
age limit. Now we have a cutoff time. We have a hard out. So
you're
to speak,
so Dan. Passe. You think like boys and girls should be competing against boys and girls? What did we just chip you out of ice? I mean, yeah, of course, it's fuddy-duddy. But here's the thing. I mean, despite what you might think, because of Charlize Theron or some of these other kooks, that it's okay to start. Butchering your toddler if they indicate they identify something other than their biological sex. The World Professional Association for Transgender Health just lowered its recommended minimum age for starting gender transition hormone treatment to 14 and some surgeries to 15 or 17. But FINA is saying
it's got to be 12.
Right.
By age 11, if you don't know, you're not competing.
Although the question is,
what does, when you say,
encouraged to transition by the age of 12. So you can't just identify. You got to get the works.
Right. You can't just say I'm feeling like a man.
Right. But you still gotta carry around that that tool.
Well, what Leah Thomas did was he performed his freshman and sophomore year where he did very well.
He's a tucker, though.
Well, right. But then his junior year, he took the hormones, but he's still a tucker.
Yeah.
And he had to take the hormones because it was too much.
I was barely going to classes. I could really barely get out of bed. And I said, I can't live like this anymore. I want to be able to do things I enjoy.
Even if it might cost me my swimming
career. Yeah, and that's part of what kept me from transitioning for so long is I wasn't sure if I could continue swimming and doing the sport that I loved.
And so then he, you know, took a year off. Excuse me, a book just fell. And started taking the hormones during that year. And gosh, did you realize how weak we are? I had no idea.
The mental and emotional changes actually happened very quickly. I was feeling a lot better mentally. I was less depressed. And I lost muscle mass. And I became a lot weaker and a lot slower in the water.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing about that. I know he says it didn't have any impact on, you know, in terms of giving him a competitive advantage, but it is odd. It is odd if you go by the stats. So he won the women's 200 in March, the national championship. Mm-hmm. When he was swimming against men, he ranked 554th in the 200. But he didn't have any advantage coming over. He went from 554 to national champion.
Oh my God, that's a good stat.
I mean, okay.
Well, you know, but it's all about, so he doesn't care about Title IX and about women's rights and how we fought so hard. By the way, it's going to be 50 years of celebrating Title IX this week. He doesn't care about it. It's all about him, me, I.
There's a lot of factors that go into a race and how well you do. And the biggest change for me is that I'm happy. And sophomore year, where I had my best times competing with the men, I was miserable. And so having that be lifted is incredibly relieving and allows me to put my all into training, into racing. Trans people don't transition for athletics. We transition to be happy and authentic and our true selves.
Yeah, but while you're doing that, you're crushing the dreams of somebody who has spent their whole life training and was going to have that spot on the woman's team that he took it away from, or the title.
He's much happier as a national champion than he is as ranked 554. But here's the thing. I still don't understand. They're trying. This is like a Solomonic decision by FINA. They're trying to split the baby, aren't they?
Yeah.
And so I just wonder how this holds up. By the way, the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, since Leah Thomas
wants
to swim in the 24 games, IOC urged shifting the focus from individual testosterone levels, calling for evidence to prove when a performance advantage existed. And now we brought you a story about this woman and her organization before. Athlete Ally, which is a pro-trans advocacy organization, and Lieberman is the founder. She characterizes this policy announcement by this governing body for swimming.
Yeah.
Deeply discriminatory, harmful, and unscientific. The new policy is not in line with the IOC's framework on fairness, inclusion, and non-discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sex variations. And she, you know, prattles on. But anyway,
We haven't heard. This is a interview of Leah Thomas from 2 weeks ago. We don't know Leah Thomas's reaction to the FINA's decision.
Right. But the other thing too is, I mean, this is going to be litigated, and you know, at some point, you're going to have the high court weigh in on some of these matters in a more meaningful way as the LGBTQIA plus, you know, are seeking essentially special class status to be treated like racial minorities. And then the impact that would have on these decisions by governing bodies whose rules do not trump Supreme Court jurisprudence. Paul in Estero, Florida, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. Just, you know, we moved down here from Edison Park. We just had enough of what's going on up there. But it's hilarious that the right is saying 18-year-olds don't have the prefrontal cortex to purchase a semi-automatic weapon, but yet an abortion at 11 and a sex change at 12 is perfectly okay.
The left is.
I mean, am I missing something here?
The left.
The left. I apologize.
Yeah. No, you're not. No, you're not missing it.
The irony has not been lost.
That's a summary. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Paul. Appreciate
what's going to happen? I mean, she told Juju Chang from Channel 7 or ABC Network News that she's going to be in the, she wants to be in the Olympics. Do we want to forego a medal, guys, when we're performing in France for America by not letting her play in the Olympics?
Oh, my
gosh.
People
are going to be cheering for her if she does qualify for the team. I mean, it's just going to be very...
What if our women can't beat some other country's dude in the women's swimming competition? You're right. I'm not willing to sacrifice an Olympic medal for Western civilization. It's too high a price to pay.
Just wanted to check.
Mary in Midway, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, hello. Uh-oh, I'm going to get myself on the no-call list here.
Why?
In the previous segment, I have to correct you. Dan, you were spreading false news, and I know you like to correct others. Your very words were, they're given this, and believe me, I have no use for that guy or that other station. You guys are my station. But you said, they're giving the senior citizens something ever since Orion Samuelson passed. Orion Samuelson is alive and well. I know he's closing in on 90, but he fills in on TV for
some. No. I said passed on. I mean left WGN.
Oh, you mean?
I didn't mean.
If you listen to it, you said they're giving them something ever since Orion Samuelson passed.
Well, I meant.
Oh, you owe me a drink at the yacht club. Come on.
The yacht club.
Well, for catching you in a boo boo. Yeah. No.
Wait. What yacht club? I don't belong to a yacht club.
You used to. Well, that must be a COVID world thing because everything is closed down now.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Mary.
All right.
Appreciate it.
My head's spinning right now.
I have been to the Chicago Yacht Club.
I have been too.
Yeah, but I was never a member of the Chicago Yacht Club. I don't want to spread.
Does that boat ever leave the harbor?
No, that's the Columbia.
Oh,
Yacht
that's
Club.
Columbia. Oh, that's the one that I've been to.
You know, you should really get familiar with Chicago one of these days. How long have you been here?
I grew up here, and then I came back in 1996.
Well, no, I mean, that's not a lot of time. Yeah, it takes a while to get around the city.
I know that Madison is State Zero. I'll boom! That's all I need to know.
Right.
Yes.
Palina, Malvina, and Pete in Montgomery here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. I'm old enough to remember when we used to make fun of the East German women's Olympic athletes because they were all bearded. We've become the joke.
Right.
And this is not a joke. We're doing this. We're sending men into women's sports. What are we doing to ourselves?
Thanks for the call, Pete. No, I do remember the East German swim team jokes about them, being steroided up.
When I was a kid, people thought those were men. Didn't you?
No, I think they were women. No, they were women who were steroided up. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that was the whole thing was that they were cheating. They were doping, right?
Well, they had to be doing something. I mean.
Yeah. Well, I mean, usually.
Like Neanderthal.
Usually if you see a woman with a 5 o'clock shadow, you think, man, something's going on here. I'm not exactly sure.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.